Another major breakthrough in the chemistry-biology problem was made in the 1970s. This was called the Gaia theory, which was discovered by another great scientist named Dr. James Lovelock. Dr. Lovelock discovered how to study biology as chemistry for the entire planet at once. Dr. Dawkins and Dr. Lovelock disagreed with each other on a lot of things because they were studying biology at two different levels, using two different approaches, so it wasn't always obvious that the two fit together. Sometimes it looked like they disagreed with each other, even though they were talking about the same things using two different vocabularies. But now that I've told you how Dr. Dawkins discovered the selfish gene theory, it's easier to use the selfish gene theory to show you how Dr. Lovelock discovered the Gaia theory. Just like all the genes that create an individual person have settled into a chemical reaction that keeps working by all the genes working together to make copies of themselves, all the genes in an environment have settled into a much bigger chemical reaction that keeps working by all of the genes working together to make copies of themselves. This is where Dr. Dawkins and Dr. Lovelock misunderstood each other. All the genes in an environment don't cooperate with each other in the same way that all the genes in a horse or a person do. Every living thing in an environment is trying to eat something else, and every living thing is trying to keep from getting eaten by something else. But the result is that the whole environment, just like a species of plant or animal, keeps working the way it works because all the genes keep making copies of themselves through their interactions with all the other genes in the environment. I'm a little surprised that Dr. Dawkins didn't think of this because he's the one who discovered the selfish gene theory. That means he's the one who discovered that all the genes in a tree or a cow or a person keep working together so each one of them can keep making copies of themselves. All the genes in an environment keep working together so they can make copies of themselves. According to Dr. Dawkins' selfish gene theory, all the genes in a plant or animal only work with all the other genes in the plant or animal because it helps them make copies of themselves. Making more copies of themselves is exactly what all the genes in an environment do, even though the individual animals who carry the genes keep eating each other. This is why environments survive for thousands of years, even though individual plants and animals are born and die. Environments keep working the way they work because genes keep making copies of themselves. But that's just the beginning. When we talk about local environments, that's really just a human idea to make environments easier to think about. It works pretty well most of the time. But every local environment overlaps with all the other local environments around it, so there really is no such thing as a local environment. If you want to talk about all the genes in an environment working together and making copies of themselves in a very big chemical reaction, you have to talk about the environment of the entire Earth. Dr. Lovelock worked in the early space program here in the United States. The space scientists had already figured out how to build things that were kind of like airplanes, which could fly all the way up into outer space. They had even flown all the way to the moon, and some people got out and walked around on the moon. Now they were trying to figure out how to fly all the way to the planet Mars. Mars is a lot further away than the moon, so the scientists couldn't send people all the way to Mars. But they could send a machine to land on Mars that they could control from Earth using radios. They could put cameras on the machine to take pictures and mechanical shovels to dig up some of the dirt to see what it was made of and some other things like that, so they could learn some things about Mars without anyone having to go there. One big thing the scientists were wondering was if there was life on Mars. They wondered how they could figure that out. Since they didn't know where the life was, they didn't know where to send their machines to look for it. If they sent one or two machines to search for life on an entire planet, and the machines landed in the middle of the desert where nothing lived, they would think there was no life on Mars, but they would be wrong. So they needed to figure out a way to search the entire planet from one place. The solution someone thought of was that, here on Earth, plants and animals breathe in and out. That means they need a constant supply of certain chemicals, so they breathe in air to get the chemicals, and they breathe out air that has different chemicals. Plants and animals keep each other alive that way because animals need the chemicals the plants breathe out, and the plants need the chemicals the animals breathe out. The scientists could figure out what the chemistry of the planet was pretty easily by seeing what chemicals the rocks and dirt was made of. From that, they could see what chemical reactions would happen on Mars and what gases would be given off. Those gases would create the atmosphere. That would give them a pretty good idea about what the atmosphere should be like. That meant that all they had to do was to outfit the landing machines with equipment to test the chemistry of the air. If the chemistry of the air was a lot different from the chemistry the rocks and dirt should have made, that would be a big clue that something on Mars was breathing in and out. Dr. Lovelock didn't stay at that job very long because all he was doing was helping design a small part of the machine, and that was pretty boring to him. So he left there pretty soon. Then he got curious. Now that he knew how the experiment was going to be carried out on Mars, he tried the experiment on Earth. Before, scientists had always assumed that the atmosphere on Earth had always been pretty much like it is now, and that plants and animals had only changed it a little bit. But this is what happens when you assume you know things about the world without studying what you're talking about to see how it really works. Dr. Lovelock found out what the chemistry of the rocks here on Earth was, and from that he figured out what chemical reactions the rocks would have with each other and what gases they would give off. That told him what the chemistry of the atmosphere should be. Then he looked at what the atmosphere of the Earth really is like. Scientists have known that for a long time. What Dr. Lovelock discovered was that the atmosphere of the Earth was nothing like what the chemistry of the rocks should have produced. That means our entire atmosphere was created by the plants and animals that live on Earth. The chemistry of the atmosphere the rocks would have created is the chemistry the atmosphere must have had before life began on Earth, because before life began, the chemistry of the rocks was all the chemistry there was. That means that when the first gene molecule was created, it probably didn't need to breathe. But either that gene, or one that was created sometime after it, started making chemical reactions happen that created new kinds of gas. So these gases were added to the atmosphere. Eventually, a gene was created that could use some of the chemicals from the air to help make copies of itself. That meant it started changing the atmosphere in another way by taking chemicals out of the air. Over about 1.5 billion years, the genes and cells living on Earth changed the atmosphere from what it was then to what it is now. Then Dr. Lovelock studied the chemistry of the oceans. The oceans were another way that a lot of chemicals get circulated around on the Earth, so the plants and animals that needed constant supplies of chemicals could get some that way. Dr. Lovelock discovered that the salt content of the oceans was wrong. He could figure out what the salt content should be from the rate rainwater washed salt off the land and into the ocean. Then he compared that to the salt content of the oceans now, which was something else scientists already knew. Before then, scientists had assumed that the salt of the ocean was caused by rainwater washing salt into the oceans. But once again, they assumed they knew something about the world without testing their ideas to see if they were right. On the one hand, before Dr. Lovelock figured out how to do this, nobody had thought of studying the chemistry of the entire world or had figured out how. But on the other hand, they are scientists, so they're supposed to know better than to assume they know things without testing them to see if they're right. The salt content of the oceans is kept constant by sea animals that use ocean salt to build their shells. When the animals die, the weight of their shells makes them sink to the bottom of the ocean, where they get covered up with mud. If the chemistry of the atmosphere or the oceans was what the chemistry of the rocks and water would make it all by themselves, almost everything on Earth would die. That means that life on Earth depends on life itself. All of the things that are alive right now are alive because of the environment that was created by the living things that came before them. The combination of all the living things on Earth is what makes the environment of the Earth work the way it works. Every living thing on Earth evolved to live in the environment that was created by all the living things that came before them. Simultaneously, all the living things on Earth depend on the environment of the Earth continuing to... Simultaneously, all the living things on Earth depend on the environment of the Earth continuing to work the way it works to keep them alive. Everything on Earth has been evolving to live in the environments of the Earth for so long that by now, every single thing on Earth is used by something. Something depends on every single thing on Earth for its life. That includes every single thing that other living things leave as waste products, from the bones predators leave behind to the air people breathe out. Another big way local environments overlap with each other is easy to see. A lot of birds migrate every year. The birds are a part of the environments they live in for both parts of the year. If something happens in one place that affects the birds, it affects the environment in the other place. If some birds spend the winter in Mexico and spend the summer in Canada, the environments in Mexico and Canada affect each other. If the birds build their nests in a certain forest in Canada, and then the same people who are taking your farms go cut down that forest, the birds will have nowhere to build their nests. If they build their nests in a different forest, there will already be birds living in that forest. That means there won't be enough food for all the birds, so a lot of them will probably die. Then the next winter, when the birds are supposed to come back to Mexico, a lot of them won't come back. If there were insects that live in the jungles of Mexico, and the birds ate the insects, now there aren't as many birds, so there will be more insects. If the insects eat the leaves from the trees, now that there are more insects because there aren't as many birds, the insects will eat more leaves. But the trees need their leaves to live. If too many of the trees' leaves get eaten, the trees won't be as healthy. Now the jungle in Mexico will start to die because someone cut down a forest in Canada. For another example, I'm sure you know that wearing light-colored clothing in the hot sun keeps you cooler than wearing dark-colored clothing. That's because dark colors soak up more sunlight, and that turns into heat. Light colors reflect more light, which is why they are light colors, because more light bounces off them and goes into your eye. Snow is white. That makes it the lightest color of all. Now that air pollution is causing the greenhouse effect, the atmosphere is warming up. That's making snow melt all over the world. The more snow melts, the less white snow reflects light. The ground under the snow isn't white, so it absorbs more sunlight than the snow did. That loss of snow creates an additional way the world absorbs more heat than it did before, and that makes the greenhouse effect even worse. That makes more snow melt, and that makes more ground soak up heat, and that makes more snow melt, and so on. There are many things like this that can happen that scientists have figured out now that they know about the Gaia theory. Some of the things would be very difficult for me to explain to you. School teachers or university students could learn more about this and teach you more. What all these things have in common is that someone does something that has an effect on something else, and that has an effect on other things which the person didn't expect. Anytime people do anything to the environment, they make it stop working as well as it did before. If you extract something from the environment, you throw off some chemical reactions of the environment. That throws off more chemical reactions of the environment. The environment can withstand those things to a point because the new combination of plants and animals can balance themselves out again. But if you keep doing things like that, eventually your environment breaks down. Then your healthy forests start to die and turn into thinner forests with smaller trees with less living things in them. Then thin forests turn into grasslands, and grasslands turn into desert, and so on for every kind of environment. Planetary biology is a very tricky thing, because people can't live without having an effect on the environment. However, people can't naturally perceive the entire world or the effects they have on it. As long as people were living by hunting and gathering, they had very little effect on the environment. They changed the environment. In some places they changed the environment a lot, and in some places they destroyed the environment. Here in America, some of the Indians would hunt by setting forests or grasslands on fire. Other Indians who lived in the desert would move from place to place, plant crops, eat everything they could find until there was nothing left to eat, and then move on to do the same thing somewhere else. That worked for a while, but eventually their entire environment broke down because it didn't recover fast enough, and they had nowhere left they could go to find anything to eat. Those people disappeared because their tribes broke up and the people joined other tribes who lived in other places. Other people in other parts of the world made the same kinds of mistakes. But whatever people did as hunter-gatherers, it was never enough to destroy the environment of the entire Earth all at once. People destroyed the environment in some places, but for the most part, they didn't. 10,000 years ago, that began to change when people first learned how to farm. Before, an environment was made up of thousands of plants and animals all living together and each of them creating the things other plants and animals needed to live, including being their food. But when you clear out a whole field or forest to plant one crop in it, you change the environment of the area to one where only one kind of plant grows. An environment with only one kind of plant growing in it is not a healthy environment. Lots of some chemicals get produced, and lots of some chemicals get used up, and the other parts of the environment that had turned the new chemicals back into the old chemicals before are gone. So then you have to do things like bring in fertilizer from elsewhere, rotate your crops from year to year, and let your land lie fallow once every few years. Right now, people are using about 50% of the land area of the earth for farming, factories, mining, logging, cities, towns, and villages. Doing any of those things means tearing out the natural environment and replacing it with something else. Most of the land we use is for farming. That means that with farming alone, we've already destroyed almost 50% of the environment of the earth. In a way, it sounds like farmers have been destroying the environment more than anyone else. It's true that farmers have been destroying the environment a lot more than most people realize, because farming doesn't destroy the environment in ways that are as obvious as cutting down a whole forest and building a city or building a factory or mining coal or something. Farming looks like people growing plants, and growing plants is what the environment was doing anyway. The problem is that the farmers aren't growing the right combination of plants to keep the environment working. In another way, however, everyone has helped to destroy the Earth's environment with farming. Everyone needs something to eat, and everyone's food comes from farms, with the exception of a few people who are still hunter-gatherers. Who worked on the farms doesn't really matter. Someone had to work on the farms. If everyone worked on the farms and grew their own food, then everyone would have helped destroy the environment. Anything else that people do to get their food depends on someone growing food on farms. This is an example of why people learning about planetary biology is important, no matter who they are. Since we all have an effect on the environment, we all need to learn what effect we have on the environment, and what we can do to have a different effect on the environment. Teaching people about planetary biology means teaching it to them in whatever way they learn best, not just teaching it to a few people who know a lot about science and telling everyone else they're just too dumb to understand it. This is also an example of what happens when people who don't know much about how plants and animals live try to take everyone's farms and be the farmers for the whole world. I've heard a lot about the milpas farmers grow in southern Mexico. The milpa is probably the most highly developed form of farming in the world. Instead of growing one kind of plant in a field, you grow a dozen plants. Those dozen plants make a well-balanced diet, and they also help fertilize each other, give each other shade, or help each other reach the sunlight. You don't need to rotate your crops or let your land lie fallow. A farmer can grow all the food he needs out of one field for his entire life. In some fields, farmers have been planting milpas every year for 4,000 years. I'm not telling you this because you didn't already know it. I'm telling you what I've heard. Considering everything you and your ancestors obviously figured out about farming in order to plant milpas, and considering everything I've told you about planetary biology so far, I hope you can see that you figured out a lot more about farming than you realized. A milpa isn't just a farm. It's an environment. A lot of people think you're dumb peasant farmers because you don't farm big fields with big machinery. How little those people know. You've built the biggest farm machine in the world, but it's completely invisible. You don't need to buy a tractor to help you grow a milpa because you figured out how to plant crops that would help grow each other, which means they do the work of a tractor for you. Probably the greatest environmental scientist in the world today figured out the Gaia theory, but your ancestors figured out how to build Gaia machines 4,000 years ago. Now those people who aren't nearly as smart as they think they are come and take your farms, call you dumb peasants, tear out your milpas, and use their big machines to plant their big fields with one crop. And they say they know more about farming than you do, because they know how to get more food out of the land than you do. But that doesn't prove anything. If they can get more food out of the land than you could every year for 50 years or even 100 years before the local environment breaks down the way it does in a lot of places where people farm too much, what does that prove? How much food have you gotten out of the land in 4,000 years? However much it is, I bet it's a lot more than anyone could get out of the land with a tractor in 100 years. This is an example of science depending on people looking at all the evidence, including the evidence that contradicts what they want to believe. If they want to talk about who can get more food out of the land than who, they have to look at all the numbers. Meanwhile, those same kinds of people who are trying to farm the entire world but don't know nearly as much as they think they do are causing a different version of the same problem. I don't know how much you've heard about things that have been happening in the United States the past few years. In 2001, some people who were kind of like you in a few ways anyway, got tired of Americans coming to their countries and telling everyone what to do. A lot of Americans say those people are insane or their religion makes them hate us, but I'm not so sure about that. We obviously did something to them because they don't hate people in Canada or Japan or anywhere else nearly as much as they hate us. Those people attacked the United States one morning by hijacking big airplanes and crashing them into buildings. They destroyed a couple of buildings and killed about 3,000 people. We call those people terrorists because they fight by killing as many civilians as they can on purpose. Meanwhile, here in the United States, with all our factories and our cars, we produce a lot of air pollution. That's true in Mexico also, and every other country in the world, but here in America, we create more pollution than any other country. Some of that pollution traps the heat in the atmosphere, which is making the earth heat up. That's called the greenhouse effect. Hurricanes are created by hot air. As the atmosphere warms up because of our air pollution, it's going to make bigger hurricanes. In 2005, a huge hurricane, which we call Hurricane Katrina, hit the United States and completely destroyed New Orleans, which is a large city on the Gulf of Mexico. It destroyed a lot of smaller towns and cities also. It killed about 1,800 people, or maybe more, and it left 3 million people homeless. 3 million people is 1% of the population of the United States. I've told you how humanity has been destroying the environment in various ways for 10,000 years without realizing it. Now the environment is fighting a war against us a lot like the terrorists are. The only difference is, when the terrorists fight us, they destroy buildings. When the Earth fights us, it destroys cities. But the people who are taking your farms and trying to farm the entire world, or people just like them, are also the ones who own all those factories and keep producing all that pollution. They say they know a lot about science because they know how to build factories. That doesn't prove they know anything about science. All that proves is that they've figured out how to use scientific discoveries to build factories. If you aren't willing to look at all the scientific discoveries and see what they mean, you don't even know what science is. When you look at all the scientific discoveries people have made, you can see why it's a mistake for the people to take your farms. All the scientific discoveries put together say that one-crop farming and factories are both destroying the environment of the Earth. If these people really knew as much about science as they say they do, they wouldn't be taking your farms and tearing them down. They would be coming to work on your farms and learn what you know, so that they could plant milpas all over the world. All the scientific discoveries put together say that milpa farming is the best way to farm without destroying the local environment, and without needing farming machines that create air pollution that cause the greenhouse effect. If those people who are trying to farm the world knew anything about how to farm the world, they wouldn't be tearing out your milpas and replacing them with single-crop farms. They would be tearing out their single-crop farms and replacing them with milpas. Dr. Lovelock called his discovery the Gaia Theory for a specific reason. I've already told you how the scientific story of the origins of life on Earth began with the Earth creating life. A lot of religions around the world have creation stories that begin that way. I've told you how you can recognize that same story continuing to be told in every living thing you ever see. A lot of religions have stories like that, too. Now Dr. Lovelock had discovered that, in a way, the Earth itself was alive. In the same way that all the genes in your body work together to make copies of themselves, and they keep making copies of themselves because the way they make copies of themselves works pretty well, all the genes on Earth work together to make copies of themselves, and they keep making copies of themselves because the way they make copies of themselves works pretty well. A lot of religions have stories about the Earth being alive also. Dr. Lovelock realized that what he had discovered affected everyone, so he tried to make his discovery understandable to everyone. To do that, he named his discovery after Gaia, a goddess of the Earth from an ancient Greek religion, because a lot of people knew about stories like that, so that would help them understand what he had discovered. Dr. Lovelock was trying to do what I'm doing now, only he wasn't as good at it as I am. Of course, the things he had to work with to try to do what I'm doing were different also, because there was no internet back then, so people couldn't spread their ideas all over the world then as easily as they can now. He was trying to explain his scientific discoveries to people who didn't know much about science by comparing them to things people did know about. In the same way, I'm teaching you about biology now by comparing it to farming. Naming a scientific theory after an ancient goddess helped in some ways and didn't help in other ways. It did make Dr. Lovelock's discovery understandable to a lot of people who wouldn't have understood it otherwise. But it made a lot of scientists mad. A lot of people who weren't as great of scientists as he was tried to prove his discovery was wrong, or else they ignored it because they couldn't make the distinction in their minds that the name Dr. Lovelock gave it was just a name, and it had nothing to do with whether his discovery was right or wrong. When Dr. Lovelock wrote his first book, he could see that the environment of the Earth was in a lot of trouble. He was trying to warn people that they had to start living differently or a lot of things were going to go wrong. but it took other scientists so long to stop complaining about the name he gave to his discoveries and realize that his discoveries were right that by the time they did, the problems he was trying to warn them about were already happening. Scientists are people just like everyone else. A few are extremely smart, and many are very stupid. This is true for people who live in the United States and England, which is where Dr. Lovelock is from, and other places in the industrialized world, in a way that it isn't true for peasant farmers. When you're a peasant farmer, you have to know a lot about a lot of different things. You seem dumb to people from the United States because you aren't very worldly. As farmers, you know a lot about dirt, you know a lot about seeds, you know the best ways to cut down plants, and so on. You're very specialized at a particular job, but you also know how to do all the other jobs that need to be done around your farm, like how to take care of your animals, how to build storage sheds, how to dig irrigation trenches, and all the other things your farm depends on. You're very good at doing one of the most important jobs in the world, producing food. You don't make much money at what you do, but if you know how to do everything yourself, including grow your own food, you don't need to make much money. Here in the United States, a lot of people who are very good at certain things specialize in their jobs also, but they don't learn how to do anything else. That would be like if you knew everything about how to grow plants, but when you needed an irrigation ditch, you sat around and cried about it until someone else came and dug it for you. These Americans, some of whom are scientists, are intelligent people, but that isn't the same thing as being smart. Discovering things and learning things is one thing, but what do you do then? How do you put the information to use? A lot of Americans use what they know to make money, 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 and they think that proves they're smart. But it doesn't. That only proves they're good at a particular thing. They still don't know how to grow their own food or raise their own animals or otherwise provide for themselves all the things they need to live. They do provide for themselves, but they do it by focusing on how to do one job, getting paid money for it, and then using the money to buy all the things they need. When they want food, they buy it. When they want a shed built, they pay someone else to build it for them. When they want an irrigation ditch dug, they pay someone else to dig it for them, and so on. Whatever people do in life, if they only know how to do one thing, when things change and they need to know how to do something else, or need to think about a lot of things all at the same time, they're completely useless. This is why most Americans think you're just a bunch of dumb farmers. Most Americans don't care about dirt or seeds or the best way to cut plants or raising animals or building sheds or digging irrigation ditches. They care about buying new cars and new TVs and new clothes and things like that. You don't know anything about that, so they assume you're just dumb peasants. But where do all the things they buy come from? And how many more will they be able to buy? They have no idea. They assume someone else keeps track of those things and that someone else knows what to do. But what if nobody is keeping track? What if some people think they're keeping track, but they're wrong? What if everyone is just doing what they feel to be right and assuming it's supposed to work and causing a lot of problems in the world and they can't figure out where the problems are coming from? It will take me the rest of this book to tell you all about that. Where I grew up, nobody had very much, so we all had to learn how to do most things for ourselves. I lived on the coast, so there were a lot of fishermen where I lived. It was in a forest, so there were a lot of loggers also. There were also some farmers. I didn't learn how to do those things, but I learned how to do a lot of other things. I learned how to build houses, fix cars, and a lot of other jobs that involve buildings and machinery. I also learned how to be an artist, how to write books, and how to fly helicopters. I've also learned a lot about math, science, history, philosophy, and a lot of other things. That's why it's so easy for me to learn about all these different things that scientists have discovered and see how they all fit together. That's also why a lot of scientists assume I can't possibly fit all these scientific discoveries together, because they all assume that I'm supposed to be just as dumb as they are. By that I mean they're intelligent people with highly specialized education and no common sense. This is a big reason why I'm writing this book about planetary biology for peasant farmers. These scientists make a lot of big talk about how much they're figuring out about what's going wrong with the world, but they don't realize how much they're contributing to the problems they're studying. A lot of them think that learning about one field of science proves they're so smart, they can prove that anyone who tries to teach science to people who aren't scientists in ways those people can understand it can't possibly know anything about science. So on the one hand, these specialized scientists keep trying to prevent anyone from doing anything to solve problems in the world, and on the other hand, they keep complaining about how all the problems in the world keep getting worse. Like I said, lots of intelligence, lots of education, and no common sense. I've written another book like this one for scientists, but I'm not really planning on many of them reading it. But you're practical people who spend your lives working with plants and animals, and who know a lot about a lot of different things. The specialized scientists already know some important things about planetary biology, and you already know other important things about it. All that left for me to do was to fill in a few gaps. Now we'll just see who's smarter than who. The Gaia theory gives us another good point of reference for talking about biology. Anytime you talk about biology, you're talking about individual genes copying themselves, and simultaneously, you're also talking about billions of genes all copying themselves by interacting with each other. You can talk about the Gaia theory in terms of chemical reactions, or, if it's easier, in terms of food chains and life cycles of plants and animals, and you can shift back and forth between chemistry and biology as necessary.